Hey, it's morning PDP.
Shut up. You don't need to yell.
I hate it. I hate it so much. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Tyler.
How are you?
I'm fine. It's earlier for me than it is for you, so
it
you
is.
Should quit complaining.
It is. That's true. And I went to bed super early last night, so I was awake actually like long before this podcast. So I feel like I should feel way more awake than I do, but I don't because I hate mornings and pretty much everything else in life these days. So that's good.
It's like, my whole life is one morning.
Basically, I'm like a Garfield cartoon.
Oh, Mondays.
Garfield minus Garfield. So hi everybody, it's the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. I'm Tyler Mon,
and I'm Anthony Masterson,
brought to you by the good folks at purpleroad.com, which you can go to for all of the latest and greatest with your Colorado Rockies. This week's episode is episode number 94 of the old PDP, the Colorado Rockies in 1994 and the rest of Major League Baseball endured quite a strike, wiped out the World Series. Wiped out maybe a 400 hitter in Tony Gwynn. Wiped out the greatest Montreal Expos team of all time. So yeah. 1994 was great.
I was just down in San Diego this past weekend and partook in quite a few 394 pale ales. The Tony Gwynn beer. Yeah, very good.
Those are good, yeah. Man, I still sometimes just think about the fact that Tony Gwynn is no longer with us, and that makes me as depressed as almost anything else in the world.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, the 94 season, there was a lot of good stuff going on that was ruined by the strike of 1994. The only time that the World Series has been wiped out, due to a labor stoppage, but thankfully labor peace in the, 20 plus years since, and we are set for another season of baseball as, we get ready for games to open here in just a few days for your Colorado Rockies. Diamondbacks actually played yesterday. They played Grand Canyon University, which advertises so much on TV that I feel like it's just like DeVry, but apparently it's a real school.
Apparently they are a real school.
Yeah,
and they're going to be D1 and eligible for postseason play in like every sport.
Really?
And their basketball team is going to be very good next year because Dan Marley.
Yeah, Dan Marley's the coach.
He's the coach.
Yeah.
They almost beat Louisville this year. They play in the WAC. Their baseball team is actually pretty good too. They're going to be some kind of like, you know, Christian for-profit university, but also with a good sports team.
Jerry Colangelo has some kind of connection too.
Yeah.
He's the namesake of their business college, I know. So yeah, they have all these random sports connections, and yeah, Dan Marley, and it's very random, very strange. But yeah, apparently, they're going to be, you know, a sporting powerhouse. They played the D-backs yesterday. And that was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
So baseball's here. And with that, the latest edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Get excited. It's our first one of February. And likely our last one of February.
Since it's almost the end of February.
Ends in 5 days. We're excited to roll. We'll talk a whole lot of Rockies today. We'll be joined by Jason Schwartz, the radio voice of the Class A Advanced Lancaster Jethawks in the California League, the Rockies' new High A affiliate.
And the Long Beach State women's basketball team.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk all kinds of things Long Beach State basketball. So that'll be good. He's our second Long Beach State basketball play-by-play guy on the podcast currently. So that'll be fun. And before we get into things today, hey, you can head on to iTunes and the Stitcher app and wherever else you find your podcast and give the old PDP a rating and a review and a subscription if you are so kind, because, you know, that's cool and it helps us figure out who's listening and who likes us and all the other fun stuff. We are at 20 reviews on the old PDP, and we've got 4.5 stars because of the one dude who gave us 1 star because he was angry at us from Twitter.
Connor.
Shocker, Connor, you jerk. So anyway, hey buddy, how's things? I'll see you in a month, less than a month actually.
Today's the 23rd, so yeah, you'll be in
I'll actually be heading home
LA area on the 20th. Yeah.
Well, not heading home. I'll be heading to the Baltimore area on the 23rd. But yeah, I'll be there the 20th, 21st, and 22nd because we're going to nerd out of the WBC together.
Definitely be excited for that.
Me too. I'm really excited. Yeah,
I
Dodger
really
Stadium.
Hope the U.S. is there. My God, yeah. The U.S. better be
if
there.
If they're not,
I want to see, Jake McGee
wrong.
Get the final out of the championship game.
That would be fantastic. And then he'll put up a 6.5 ERA in the regular season. It'll be great.
Oh, American great. Hero, Jake McGee.
Jake McGee nailing down those final tough outs against Japan. It'll be terrific. Oh,
too bad there's not a Russian team.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Jake McGee could be our savior in the yeah. in the forerunner to the new Cold War.
He could stop the new or start the new Cold War.
Yeah,
I guess,
true.
As it were.
True. But yeah, so we're going to be doing that. I'm actually also I don't think you're not traveling with Long Beach State baseball, correct?
No,
because they are going to be in the Phoenix area the day that I get there. But then they leave town. They're taking on Arizona State.
Yeah. But yeah, last time they went to play at
you went
Packard
there
stadium
right
at Arizona State 3 years ago was or 4 years ago was the last time I went out and traveled with them, and the last time was the World Baseball Classic, and that was the last time when I saw them there for the first time.
Random.
Last time for the first time.
That was when you nearly caught a home run ball, and I saw you on TV at Chase Field.
I nearly caught Chris Colabello's dinger at Chase Field when Italy 10-runned Canada.
Yeah, take that, Canada. You and your compassion.
You're America's hat, Canada. How do
you
feel? You
jerks. So, hey.
Universal healthcare.
Yeah.
Nice people.
And you're nice people and your good-looking leader and who doesn't seem like a total dick in every way. Can't relate. Am I right? no, everything's great. Everything is great. Everything's terrific. Ever since November 8th, I really would love to hang my hat on something positive in the world, and I can't quite find anything yet. So the pursuit continues. 4.5 months of garbage. But that's but baseball season.
Let's hope the Rockies make that better.
Right? Baseball season is upon us, and your Colorado Rockies starting to get a little bit of pub in the national media, and we'll discuss that a little bit as we've started seeing some predictions for the 2017 season, some season previews, that type of stuff, and there are some really good ones out there, and we'll start with Fangraphs, Fangraphs.com, Eno Saris with his 10 bold predictions for 2017. Number two from Eno Saris, quote, "The Rockies will finally have the pitching to make the postseason." This seems to be the thing that everybody is catching on to, is that the Rockies pitching last year was no joke. When you adjust for park factors, park adjusted staff ERA, the Rockies had the eighth best starting rotation ERA in baseball last year.
Which is
so
crazy.
You look at those starters and you think, yeah, the numbers weren't really that flashy. But when you adjust for Coors Field, they're pretty damn good. And they're presumably going to get better this year. You know, obviously you don't want to put a whole ton of stock into just the blind hope that everything is going to get better. Because as we saw last year with the bullpen, things can always get worse. But when you look at 1-4 in this rotation, it's dudes who have already proven that they can be there and they can compete. And the two guys competing really for number five, Jeff Hoffman and Herman Marquez, very highly touted prospects. Jeff Hoffman, you would think, would have the leg up just because of his ultimate ceiling. But this is a rotation that right now looks very good. John Gray, Tyler Anderson, both rookies last year. Chad Bettis and Tyler Chatwood, both veteran guys who have proven that they have the ability to do what it takes to be successful at Coors Field. But according to Eno Saris, quote, "At the top of the rotation, the Rockies may have one of their best pitchers ever this year. John Gray was already pretty good, and then he learned how to throw a slider two ways, and then he started throwing the curveball more, and now he has a new changeup grip. He's exciting as a young ace with velocity, an elite slider, and the makeup to continue striving for a better, more complete arsenal. But this is more about the lesser-known names behind Gray. Tyler Anderson doesn't have a ton of pitches, but his cutter four-seam change combo has proven itself to be a major league worthy at least. Chad Bettis only has average velocity, but his four-pitch combo has kept hitters off balance enough to call him a viable starter as well. Tyler Chatwood may only have the two fastballs and a slider, but he throws the curve sometime, and his sinker is all world. All three are adept at getting ground balls, and the rotation just put up their second best rate since they started tracking that number." So those four guys right now, that's already something you could build on. And Jeff Hoffman, presumably the guy right now who you would think is the leader in the clubhouse for the number five spot, he's got the ceiling of a number two, number three guy in a major league rotation.
Yeah, he's got the second highest ceiling, I would imagine, of anybody who is competing for those spots right now. And we saw what Anderson could do last year with the ground balls. We saw Chatwood, what he's done. His splits, as we've mentioned many times on this podcast, were zany. But John Gray is the linchpin for the Rockies rotation. They need him to step in and continue what he did last year. And you know, what I think is remarkable, what he did in his 9 start cameo in 2015, all the way to next last year when he had 29 starts, he kept his fielding independent pitching the exact same. 3.65 in both years, which is really, really hard to do. That means you've done a lot of things very consistently that you are able to control. But his ERA, even though his FIP stayed the exact same number, his ERA last year dropped a full run. His WHIP dropped nearly 40 points. His swing and miss percentage went up 3.5%. Everything about John Gray improved last year, while the stuff that he can control stayed the exact same. And if we get more of that this year, with maybe closer to 200 innings for John Gray instead of the 168 he pitched last year, get him 30, 35 starts if he stays healthy, then he's the guy every fifth day that you can count on to be the stopper. And the Rockies haven't really had that guy since Ubaldo.
Yeah, and he started to feel that way toward the end of last season. And, you know, we talked so often about how you were really excited to see John Gray throw. I mean, when John started really getting on a roll – you know, he had that one stretch, especially through the early part of July, where it was just like every 5 days, you knew he was going to be really, really good. July 3rd, he went 6 innings, 3 runs against the Dodgers. July 8th, 6 1/3, 2 runs against the Phillies. July 17th, 7 innings of shutout ball against the Braves. July 22nd against the Braves again, this time at home, 7 innings, 1 run. July 27th against the Orioles on the road, 7 innings, 1 run. I mean, those were the types of stretches that you think, when this guy gets it figured out on a full-time basis, this is going to be fun to watch regularly. And then toward the end of the year, you know, he has the game against the Padres, the shutout over 9 innings, 16 strikeouts, a franchise record. That is a flash of everything that you want to see from a guy. And when he's able to put together what he did in June and July for a full season's worth of pitching, that's the best thing that the Rockies could hope for and expect from somebody like him, and could make him the best guy we've ever seen do this in Denver.
Yeah, I mean, that's 13-start stretch he had from May 26th to August 2nd. 2.61 ERA, 7-2 record, 81 punchouts in 82 2/3 innings, a 2.02 opponent average. I mean, that's the type of performance you expect from a guy like John Gray.
Yeah.
He only threw over 100 pitches 3 times in that 13-start stretch. But herein lies the issue with the Rockies last year. Gray, in that time, his pitcher wins in that time 7-2, which is very good, obviously, in a 13-start stretch. The team record in that time was 7-6. Seven and six when John Gray was pitching and arguably one of the best stretches of starting pitching in the Rockies history. The team itself was 7-6.
Yeah.
And that is probably a big old thanks to that bullpen back there.
V exciting. The bullpen.
Yeah.
The bullpen.
So it doesn't, really, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how well Gray, Anderson, Chatwood, whomever pitch, they still need somebody to get the final 9 outs, as it were. And the Rockies think that they have gone enough of a way to get to that point. We shall see, because we always think that they're trying to improve the bullpen in every single year, and it never seems to go the way they would dream it. And
right.
Now, and what we mentioned here, we weren't thrilled by the Mike Dunn signing. I'm not sure how good he's going to be coming over, but
yeah.
I liked the Greg Holland signing a lot. I mean,
same.
It's a low risk signing that they were able to make. And if he comes back to any sort of the form he was a couple years ago, and he was one of the best relievers in baseball, then they could have a really nice piece on their hands. But it's going to be about the evolution of 3 guys, in my opinion, 3 guys who really will, who have developed in a world of baseball where the strikeouts are king. And those 3 guys are Jairo Diaz, Carlos Estevez, and Miguel Castro. The Rockies bullpen will be as good in 2017 as much as those 3 guys can improve, or in Jairo Diaz's case, bounce back from Tommy John surgery.
Yeah.
If those 3 guys step up, and they're still very, very young, if they step up and they perform like big leaguers, like we think they are with the talent that they have and the arsenal that they have with the high 90s fastballs and everything. If they come in and they make that progression from, you know, inconsistent youngsters to flame throwing, strikeout getting late inning relievers, this Rockies rotation, this which will make the rotation better. The Rockies' bullpen is going to be great, and the Rockies in and of themselves, because of their offense, will be so prodigious, especially at home. They're going to have a very, very good chance to compete. But in my opinion, it is all on those three young, flame-throwing right-handers at bullpen: Estevez, Castro, and Jairo Diaz.
Jairo Diaz, I'm so excited to see back. 21 games he appeared in for the Rockies in 2015, a 2.37 ERA. 19 innings, he struck out 18. He only walked 6. He is such a fun arm. You know, he's a big, big dude. He throws 1,000 miles an hour. Like you said, coming back from Tommy John surgery, obviously there's going to be a curve on which he is graded for his return. But Miguel Castro and Carlos Estevez, I think you're right. Those guys have to come back and they have to be good. They're still young. Both of them are still really young, but they have to continue taking steps forward. And I think that was one of the things that was most encouraging about John Gray was, you know, at the end of 2015, we heard all this nonsense. Is Coors Field already in John Gray's head? Have the Rockies already lost John Gray's development? Blah, blah, blah. No, John Gray came out and said, this is a difficult place to play. I need to learn how to be good here. And then guess what? He learned how to be good. So I think that mentality, if that's the type of thing that spreads through the clubhouse, if that's something that Carlos Estevez, guys like that, are able to embrace and build on, and I think Estevez is a perfect case because he's a guy, a great attitude guy, a really, his baseball aptitude seems to be very high as well. His stuff, Miguel Castro's stuff, Jairo Diaz when he's healthy, it's as good as anybody on this pitching staff. And you also have a group of guys now that are veterans that I think, even if they take their knocks, they're very valuable in what they can impart to those young guys. Yeah, Chad Qualls and Jason Mott are not world beaters anymore. But if they are effective, they, I think, have the ability to really add a lot of pieces, not just on the field, but in the makeup of that group in the bullpen and in the lessons that you're able to teach to the younger guys that you don't necessarily have otherwise. So it's not just that they threw some money at these guys and they're out there to eat up innings and take time in the bullpen, you know, that isn't now going to go in high leverage situations to those arms, you would think. But I think they add a lot of dimensions outside of that. The Rockies' best case scenario is that those guys are effective and they get pushed out of jobs by Carlos Estevez, by Miguel Castro, right, by Jairo Diaz. You don't want to be in a situation where Jason Mott and Chad Qualls are dumpster fires, you know, and Mike Dunn maybe in that group as well, are just awful in April. And all of a sudden you're throwing out the Scott Obergs of the world, or you're putting Diaz back in there before he's ready, which I don't think they'll do because it's a health issue with him. But Miguel Castro is the type of guy who, you know, he really, I think, is in a crucial year for his development because he was brought up so young by the Blue Jays. The Rockies had him up last year. He looked brilliant at times. Then he got sent back down to Albuquerque, and they kind of forgot about him for the rest of the year, battled some health stuff. So I think this is a big year for him to make a leap forward.
He's going to be 22 the entire season, too,
and that's what's insane about Miguel Castro.
He's Christmas Eve.
He's so young still. He's so young. He made his major league debut at 19 or 20?
20, yeah.
So, you know, there's by no means a clock running out on him, but I do think with the fact that he's had major league experience already, he needs to show something this year that suggests he's going to be an elite reliever, which is what his arsenal and what his ability to perform on the mound would suggest about him. You just need to see it in results. But the Rockies need the rest of that bullpen to hold its water through April and May. And then you start mixing those guys in bigger and bigger spots and getting them more acclimated to the roles that you really want to see from them down the road. But I think, you know, even in this spot, and we've talked about this a lot, you have to feel like the bullpen is going to be better just because it can't be as bad as it was last year.
You know, we always say that.
Yeah.
But it always ends up being worse than the year before.
Yeah. That's what I've learned about life over the last couple of years is no matter what, it can really always get worse, like infinitely worse.
No matter how bad things get, there's always beer.
Yeah, true. There's always booze. RJ Anderson of CBS Sports had a really good season preview, and he kind of nailed it this way for the Rockies. He said, quote, "The Rockies probably won't have the majors' worst bullpen in 2017, and best case scenario is probably an effective endgame trio with shaky mid-relief work. We'll see if that's enough."
Yeah,
Adam Ottavino, obviously, you know, he's going to be good. Greg Holland, right, you would think is going to be good in his return. Jake McGee cannot be as bad as he was at times last year, you would hope. So you hope that those three guys are kind of, you know, like you said, your effective end game group. But in the middle right now, there are some question marks.
And with Castro, the big thing is getting ahead in the count. I mean, he was very, very good when ahead in the count last year and very, very bad when behind it. He got a swing and miss percentage about 30%, which is closer to elite level than not. But he threw a first pitch strike 42% of the time. With a guy like his with his kind of stuff and the swing and miss slider that he has, yeah, he needs to get ahead of batters. He's got a fastball that reaches in the high 90s. He needs to be able to get ahead of hitters to make that slider that much more effective. He averaged 96 miles an hour on the fastball last year. But if you're constantly in the dirt, 1-0, 2-0, you got to come back with that fastball. Who cares if it's 96 or 106? Guys can catch up to it. And that's the issue with Miguel Castro. You got to get him going early in the count. That's the biggest difference for him this year. That's what they're trying to figure out. And Estevez, too, in a lot of ways. Estevez threw a first pitch strike 57% of the time. Those are atrocious numbers for guys with that kind of stuff. They need to be able to either harness their fastball or learn to throw their breaking stuff for strikes early in the count to get them ahead. Because the splits, when you get ahead 1-0, 2-0 versus 0-1, 0-2, it's stupid how much better you can make yourself just by being more consistent in the strike zone early in the count. And that's,
it was the same way.
It's not like they're not trying to throw strikes, obviously, but it's something you need to work on and get better at, because that's the biggest thing for them this year, is to be able to get in the head in the count early.
It was the same way for Castro at Triple A Albuquerque too. You know, he was, I think opponents batted about 130 against him when he was ahead in the count, and something like 455 when he was behind in the count. And when you're going to trust guys in high leverage spots, especially at Coors Field, and we saw this so often last year with Carlos Estevez, you cannot dig yourself holes by putting guys on with free passes, by getting behind in counts, and then having to, you know, following up walks with hitters counts, and then having to put something in the zone. I mean, we saw it in that game against the Marlins last year, in which he just melted down in the ninth. You just can't have that.
Castro last year, after getting a first pitch strike, opponents at 217 off him. After a first pitch ball, 382.
Yeah, not good.
I mean,
not good.
That tells you all I need to know right there.
Not good. So that's really what it all hinges on. And, you know, we're still talking about things kind of in the abstract because we haven't seen anybody in games yet. But this is really the crucial element for the Rockies. You feel like the starting staff is going to hold water. The lineup is very good. There are some question marks, I guess, most notably Ian Desmond. You just wonder how the adjustment to a position that he's never played before is going to affect him at the plate, if it does at all. But that's a very common thing that happens in baseball. Trying to learn a new position, you carry some of those struggles if you're having an issue with it over to the plate sometimes. So that's a question mark. The catching spot is a question mark. You know, is Tom Murphy your guy? If he is, how does his bat play? His bat was great at Coors Field. It was awful everywhere else. Very limited sample size, but still, Tony Wolters, can he be something approaching a major league average hitter behind the plate if he is your guy in that starting role as catcher? Everybody else seems to be fine, but those are a couple of question marks there. The bullpen is really right now where the biggest adjustments need to happen for 2017. And I think one thing that cannot be counted out is the fact that you have a manager who is much more adept at managing a pitching staff than arguably any manager in franchise history. It's not just a shot at Walt Weiss. Bud Black has long been lauded for his ability to work with pitching staffs, and doing it at Coors Field is a much different animal than anywhere else. So wouldn't you want to hire a guy who's already been plugged for that throughout his entire career? So I think that's a big asset for the Rockies too.
And considering Bud Black was somebody the Rockies have had their eye on for about a decade as someone who could lead their team and be able to figure out how to pitch at Coors Field, the Rockies are very confident going in with Bud Black. Bud Black's already getting some Manager of the Year recognition.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and it makes sense a little bit because a lot of people right now, as I especially thought they would at the beginning of the offseason, I said, you know, the Rockies this offseason is going to be just like the Padres were 2 years ago and the Diamondbacks were last year. The offseason NL West darling who people are going to look at and go, hey, these guys might not be too bad. And then we saw what happened with the Padres and the Diamondbacks, and let's hope the Rockies don't get that.
But, well, and I think the good news for the Rockies is they're not getting that notoriety for the same reasons. It's not because they went out and threw a ton of money at a bunch of different investments.
Opposite. They're getting ridiculed for their offseason signings.
They're actually being praised for the things they've been able to do in-house. Right. The Ian Desmond signing has left everybody still scratching their heads. But, it's not what it was with the D-backs last year, where it was, look at all this money they're throwing around. This team has to be good because of what they're spending.
Yeah,
it's kind of the opposite for the Rockies.
Well, but it kind of makes sense that he's getting NL Manager of the Year pub right now, because most of the time the Manager of the Year goes to the most surprising team. I mean, that's kind of how it is, right? I mean, it's always the team that everyone that comes out of nowhere, people don't think is going to be very good, and eventually they make the playoffs or make huge strides, and then it must be like, oh, well, the manager must have done a really great job, which makes sense. So if people are saying the Rockies are going to be the biggest surprise of the National League this year, then of course Bud Black should be in the running for Manager of the Year at this point.
Yeah. I agree. We mentioned Ian Desmond, and that segues us to a story up this morning at foxsports.com. We'll let Anthony tell you about it, but Ken Rosenthal, one of our favorites,
my best friend.
Your pal, Ken Rosenthal, has a good story up on Ian Desmond and his transition to first base.
Yeah, we've been inundated so far with a lot of pub from media types about how atrocious the Ian Desmond signing was, the 5-year, $70 million signing that they brought him in, considering the first base market was flush with a lot of, admittedly, all bat, no glove first basemen, your Chris Carters, your Mark Trumbos, your Edwin Encarnacion's. And Ken Rosenthal's article this morning on foxsports.com, he made the point that it wasn't just about the market for the Rockies and Jeff Bridich. It was about the fact that they wanted to find, quote, the best baseball player, one of the most athletic guys on the market, not just necessarily a first baseman, and that's where Ian Desmond came in. Quote, the Rockies targeted Desmond as a first baseman from the start of free agency. That is where they had an opening, and general manager Jeff Bridich said he viewed the potential addition of Desmond as enhancing a strength, the athleticism of the Rockies defenders, which is especially critical at the offensive incubator known as Coors Field. Most of the available first basemen were below average defenders. None was as capable as Desmond of playing other positions, either in an emergency or in the future. And Rockies manager Bud Black says that when critics of the signing focus solely on position, they miss the point. And I think that is the crux of what we're all kind of missing with this whole Ian Desmond signing. Yeah, we never thought that Ian Desmond should necessarily be the guy going forward at first base, because it didn't make sense in a very conventional way. He never played first base before in his entire life. He was a shortstop by trade. He played outfield last year. But they also make another point later in this article that when they were looking around at options for first base and looking around the league, they saw last year, they'd have to look very far in history to see an outfielder making a very decent transition to first base. And considering a guy that historically doesn't have a very well thought of reputation as a defender, they figured they could make this transition because they looked at a guy like Hanley Ramirez in Boston. Hanley Ramirez in Boston was moved from shortstop because he was bad at it, moved to left field in Boston, was bad at it, and then moved to first base, and last year had a very, very decent year defensively as a first baseman. And so considering, I know Ian Desmond, his defense eroded a little bit over his last couple years at shortstop in Washington, which kind of necessitated the move to outfield, as well as the fact that when they signed with the Rangers, they already had Elvis Andrus locked up for the next 45 years or something like that. But you look at a guy like Hanley Ramirez, if Hanley Ramirez can do it and at least do a halfway decent job of it, there's no way Ian Desmond can't be better than that. And I think that's a good corollary that you don't have to look very far in history to figure out. That's a very good option for the Rockies. And they go on to say later in the article that, you know, obviously 2017, he is planning on being the first baseman. And obviously with contract situations as they are with Carlos Gonzalez, Charlie Blackmon, who knows where those guys may be, Ian Desmond may not be the starting first baseman in 2018 or 2019, but for 2017, this is where they want him to play. They want that versatility. They love that versatility. And they know that obviously Trevor Story, he got hurt last year and they didn't really have anybody else to fill that void. You know, obviously they think of him as a first baseman this year, but they know that if worse comes to worse, Ian Desmond can get plugged back into the shortstop spot if necessary, or an outfield spot if necessary, and contribute the same way he would as a first baseman. And even Bud Black went so far as to say, quote, if you look at other first basemen, Joey Votto's athletic, Paul Goldschmidt is athletic, Wes Parker back in the 60s was a switch hitting defender who was a good player, Keith Hernandez didn't hit homers, he hit for average, and he was a great defender. You know, Craig Biggio, catcher, second base, center field. Robin Yount, shortstop, center field. Good players move around at times, which goes back to Black's original thought. Quote, let's get another good player. And I think that is that's all we need to know, at least at this point right now, for this Ian Desmond signing. We don't know how well he's playing. We know he's going to be putting in a ton of work in spring training defensively. We're getting a lot of stories rolling in now about how Desmond staying after, coming in early, taking ground balls, trying to work with DJ LeMahieu, figuring out, you know, the area that he can patrol and what balls DJ can get to. That's what we're missing with this Desmond thing. We need to see it play out first before we all start criticizing it like we have been. But the points that Ken Rosenthal makes and the point that Bud Black, Jeff Breidich make in the article, it makes you believe that this isn't the quote-unquote dumbest move of the offseason. Thanks, Dave Cameron.
Yeah, and, you know, I think when we started talking about this move back over the, over the winter, it was very easy to say, oh, my God, it's the Rockies. What are they doing? Because it just kind of had the feel of, like, everybody else is playing chess while the Rockies are playing checkers. And in the ensuing couple of months, I've really sort of changed my tune on it because for so long, the knock on the Rockies has always been you have to be more creative to succeed at Coors Field. You have to think a couple steps ahead of everybody else to succeed at Coors Field. You have to try something different. This isn't the same as just being able to build a team that can compete at Kauffman Stadium or Wrigley Field or Citi Field or wherever. Playing in Denver is a different beast. And the Rockies go out, they do something somewhat unusual. They have their reasons and their justification for it. Maybe it's going to work. I mean, this is something that I think people have wanted to see from the Rockies organization for a long time, which is growth and adaptability. So maybe this idea is not as crazy as it sounds. And the thing that I love is what Anthony pointed out early on talking about this story is that it wasn't just that the Rockies said, okay, there's a guy out there, let's go throw some money at him. He's been good at a couple different locations so far in his career, both position-wise and team-wise. Why don't we just go try to make a splash and sign somebody for big money? The Rockies said he's the most athletic guy out there. And not only that, but let's research other guys who kind of fit this mold and see how they've been.
I mean, Desmond's a 2020 guy. Hanley was a 2020 guy. You know, it was a 30-30 guy.
And that, to me, suggests a lot of maturity in the front office, a lot of growth in the front office. We know Jeff Breidich listens to the podcast. Jeff, nice job. But no, I
Jeff,
think
we love
that,
you. Jeff.
I think
Jeff, do you need
early
help?
On, it was so easy to dump on this move and just say it's the Rockies being the Rockies. And, you know, like the conversation went, it's the worst move of the offseason, as Dave Cameron said. But I don't necessarily look at it that way now. I think that the Rockies had a plan to this that was deeper than what most people thought. Now, that being said, I don't think it's going to come struggle-free. And I thought one of the interesting things was Ian Desmond talking about how it's really not that easy to practice being a first baseman. He said, quote, I hate to say a fly ball is a fly ball, talking about his adjustment to the outfield, but I can go out and shag. Everyone hits fly balls in batting practice. Nobody really hits ground balls to the first baseman. So to get a game-like rep, you're basically relying on a live fungo. So you need somebody hitting to you at first base. And that's not the same as adjusting to the angle of a ball coming off a bat on a live pitch on a live swing, the way it sort of is that way when you're shagging balls in the outfield during batting practice. So I think there is still going to be a learning curve once he gets into game action. But hey, man, that's what spring training is for.
Well, yeah.
You go out, you play 20 games in spring training, and you get those reps. Then come opening day, you feel pretty confident. Maybe you're not 100% transitioned yet, but at least you're 90 to 95% there. And the athleticism with Ian Desmond, the creativity with the front office, the ability to have a player's manager there in Bud Black, who you know is a guy who's going to have your back, is, I think, huge for somebody like Desmond to get acclimated to a new role.
Well, and the good thing for him, too, he mentioned that one of the hardest things is figuring out his range, especially with, you know, which balls he gets to, which balls DJ gets to. Thankfully for him, working on his side is the fact that he's got a gold glove second baseman who can cover
right.
a lot of ground at second base. It makes his job easier because it makes it an easier decision for him. If a ball is 5 feet to his right, 6 feet to his right, he knows he doesn't have to try for it because DJ is probably going to get to it. And I also like the fact that he said that he called guys like Eric Hosmer in the offseason.
Yeah, that was
he's,
cool.
He's grabbed over the years, but he also worked out with Carell Prime, Rockies farm man, and it was a friend of
yeah.
his. you know, minor league first baseman in the Rockies organization. The Carell Prime helped him out in the offseason, which is great for, you know, Rocks fam.
Hashtag Rocks fam. Ian Desmond said, quote, "I wasn't trying to bother anybody. I know how competition goes. I wouldn't want to help people too much. But I said, if you've got something to offer, things that you feel are difficult for you, suggestions, tips," that's the kind of stuff he was trying to gather from guys like Eric Hosmer, Mitch Moreland, who he played with, also Adam LaRoche. Hopefully didn't get any parenting tips.
Yeah. But like, he also called only guys who were in the American League, too.
Guys
who won't have to worry about, you know, trying to help him out to get in the National League wild card race.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. That's a good point. So, you know, I think it's going to be fun to watch, if nothing else. And the thing is, you know, the Rockies right now around him, they got six other guys that you know are proven major league commodities. David Dahl maybe being the one that you could argue, and Trevor Story, I guess. I mean, they're both coming off a rookie season, so you could maybe argue that they're not yet quote-unquote proven, but obviously they showed in their limited bodies of work just how good they have the potential to be regularly at the major league level. And you have two guys you're pretty confident in behind the plate. So, theoretically, seven guys in the lineup around Ian Desmond are going to hold their own. So it doesn't have to be Ian Desmond coming out and being Todd Helton right out of the gate. You know, he just has to be serviceable to a little bit above average defensively. And, you know, I think the bat is going to play. It should get better at Coors Field. Obviously, he really took a dive in the second half last year, so you need to see some consistency there. But the enthusiasm with which he has attacked the transition is really encouraging to me.
Yeah, and
I like it.
I like someone like Ken Rosenthal coming out and writing an article saying, hey, you know, maybe the Rockies aren't stupid. Maybe the Rockies aren't the worst organization. Maybe they're not absolute garbage. I don't know what it is about Daves in the national media who don't seem to like the Rockies. I don't understand. Dave Cameron, you know. Dave Zagabura, whatever his name is.
Yeah. I don't know. Him with the flattering Twitter photo.
Yeah, incredibly flattering Twitter photo.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. It wouldn't be a Rocky spring training without some shit stirring from the local papers. So this from a columnist, quote, this is actually a quote from Carlos Gonzalez to the local newspaper and the columnist who shall not be named. Quote, "I felt like Bridish was trying to make sure where we were in terms of whether I wanted to be here or not. But after that, there's been zero talks," Gonzalez said. This is in reference to a potential contract extension for Carlos Gonzalez, which it does not appear is in the offing right now. There were some reports over the offseason that the two sides were talking about an extension, but that doesn't appear to be the case right now. Carlos Gonzalez says he wants to be here. The Rockies seem to have chatted with him about that at one time. But after the 2010 season, Cargo signed a 7-year, $80 million contract extension. This is the last year of that extension. And as of right now, they don't appear to be discussing another one. I'm not sure what exactly that says at this stage. I think, you know, for the Rockies, Carlos Gonzalez is a very good player. He's also a player who's 31 years old. Guys generally don't get better after their early 30s. Last year, he was terrific, 150 games, batted .298, a .350 on-base percentage, a .505 slugging percentage, 25 homers, 100 driven in. That's coming off a 40-homer season in 2015. He's been one of the greatest players in franchise history. And the thing about Cargo, he's been healthy for the last 2 years. He played 153 games in 2015, 150 games last year. But are the Rockies right now in a position where they're thinking, if 2017 goes off the rails, he's a very intriguing piece at the deadline? I mean, is that kind of, do you think that's the suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, there's no real reason to handcuff yourself with a big contract extension for a guy like Cargo at the moment. I mean, obviously, you know, if you want to keep him around, great. But if you come in the middle of July and the team is floundering under 500, around 500, wherever you don't see a lot of things going right, and you got a chance to pick up some really good pieces from another team. I know you probably can get a ton because he's going to be a free agent, you know, 2 months later, but we've seen stranger things happen. I mean, you can move him then at that point and maybe try to get him back in the offseason, like what they could have done with Jorge De La Rosa years ago and didn't pull the trigger on.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense right now to push it or make it a deal, or unless you can find like a common ground on a short extension, 2 years, 3 years, something along those lines.
Yeah.
Because right now this is as optimistic as we have been for the Rockies in spring training in 7 years.
Coming
into 2010 to 2011. I mean, And that's players, that's front office, that's fans. Everybody involved with the Rockies seems to be excited, or at least interested, intrigued about what could happen this season for the Rocks. Because really, they're going into uncharted territory with the pitching staff they have. They've never really had a pitching staff with this kind of promise ever in history. I mean, I know they had good pitching staffs in 2007 and 2009, but those were more, you know, sturdy, veteran, more proven guys than they were guys with higher upside like they have this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Rockies have an asset in that they have depth behind the guys who are at the major league level right now in the outfield. So if Carlos Gonzalez is somebody they wanted to dangle, well, Raimel Tapia is right there. He's ready. He's probably headed back to Albuquerque to start the year. You know, nobody likes the idea of Carlos Gonzalez being dealt. But the Rockies have to be realistic about where they are, and the Rockies have to be realistic about the fact that if you want to open windows of contention that are longer than two seasons, you have to start thinking longer than two seasons away. And is it worth it to invest a bulk of money in a guy whose performance will likely be declining pretty soon? Or do you deal that guy when he is close to peak value, get a lot in return for him, and try to build on that? You know, I mean, they traded away Troy Tulowitzki, who was garbage for a large part of last season, obviously recovered toward the end of the year. The Blue Jays made a run into the postseason, but they got good pieces back for him. Miguel Castro, you hope, is a big contributor in 2017. Jeff Hoffman looks like he's going to be a big contributor in 2017. Jose Reyes was a terrific addition. But, I mean, those are the things that the Rockies need to be thinking about. And last year, beginning of the season last year, when Tulo was batting like 150 into July, it felt like the Rockies looked pretty smart for that move.
Well, I can say what Trevor Story did in place of Tulo.
Right, exactly.
When Trevor Story set that's the best damn case scenario. World on fire.
That's best case scenario. If Raimel Tapia does something like that in the event that he is called upon to replace somebody like Carlos Gonzalez. You know, I think for a long time we felt like Charlie Blackman was going to be the odd man out because David Dahl looks like a center fielder. You put him there, Cargo's in a corner, Tapia's in a corner. But if that's not the way the Rockies go, Blackman is cheaper. He has been fantastic the last couple of seasons. You know, maybe that's what the Rockies are looking at right now. So the story, I think, is obviously written in a controversial, let's bring the torches to Coors Field because Jeff Bridges is screwing over our favorite player type of way, because that's what people think sells newspapers. But I don't think that it's not an outlandish way for the Rockies to approach this. Yeah, you certainly don't want to be looking at yourselves in July as not being in contention, but you got to be realistic with yourselves. If 2017 isn't the year, 2018, you have to be able to compete in a way in which you have added something to your roster or to your farm system that is better than 2017.
Well, the better way to think about it is that 2017 isn't the window. The window is just opening.
Right.
For the Rockies.
Right, exactly.
That's the biggest difference. This isn't a got to get it done in 2017 scenario.
Yeah.
This is the start. Right. Well, this is, of course, hopefully, the start of something amazing with the Rockies. This is just the start of it.
Yeah.
This isn't the be-all, end-all.
You don't want to believe that it's going to be a one-year window of contention, and if the Rockies want it to not be, then they have to be thinking more than one move down the road. So I think, you know, again, it's written in a way to make you mad. I think, if anything, you have to look at it as the maturity of Jeff Bridges to recognize this is a roster that's going to be constantly under flux, under change. So that's smart. You can't be married to the idea that this is a guy who's been great for us. That's what's gotten the Rockies in trouble a lot in the past, is the loyalty of the front office to hand out money to guys because they've been great players. There was somebody who came over. I can't remember if this was a baseball story or a basketball story. But there was somebody who came over from a foreign league and gave a quote to the American media about, and I think actually it might have been Ichiro, but gave a quote to the American media about how strange it is that in the U.S., players are paid based on past performance, where you're rewarding guys for what they've done in the past, and you're giving them a lot of money to get worse, basically, especially athletes past the age of 30.
Get older,
and really, right, when you look at it in that context, it's true. you know, you're handing out a ton of money for somebody, rewarding them for what they've done in the past. That's all fine. That's all well and good. But you're going to be paying them a lot of money as their performance starts to decline. And that is kind of strange. It's kind of a misnomer. And when you are an organization like the Rockies and you can't afford to invest money in guys who are going to be declining, then you have to start thinking down the road. So, you know, I think it's something that's designed to get you hot under the collar and upset, and I don't think everybody should look at it that way. Obviously, nobody wants to see Cargo go, same way you didn't want to see Tulo go, but the Rockies have to be smart about that stuff. Let's move on to a less pertinent on-field topic, but still an on-field topic that we love to discuss. This is from Hardball Talk. Quote, "The Rockies have had purple elements in their livery since the team began play in 1993, first as a mere accent color and then more prominently. Now they frequently wear a solid purple alternate jersey during spring training." They wear it pretty constantly, except it hasn't really been truly purple. There's been an element of blue or maybe violet to it, less Prince circa 1984 and more, I don't know, Samuel L. Jackson in Unbreakable. It was darker and under the lights of a night game looked darker still, but not anymore. The Rockies have gone to a truer, lighter purple this season. The Rockies have adjusted their on-field purple. I think it looks good. We've discussed at length, Rockies need to embrace the fact that they're the only team in baseball that wears purple. And now they have purple, which is consistent across everything. And that was the point for the Rockies, was they wanted to make sure the jersey, the hat, the jackets, the hoodies, everything that was purple would all look the same. It used to be you walked into the Diamond Dry Goods store at Coors Field and every shade they had in there was a different shade.
Yes.
And now the point is everything will look the same. I think it looks good.
Yeah, the lilac. That's the one. So
let's go with it.
My question is, do we have to rename our podcast the Lilac Dinosaur Podcast?
The Lilac Dinosaur
being
Podcast.
Hosted by lilacrow.com?
Yeah, probably. Okay. We probably should.
Okay.
Should probably do that.
Well, yeah, it's been slow on the uptake for a lot of the players. I think Nolan Arenado said that he didn't like it as much. So if Nolan doesn't like it, then maybe I don't like it either, because I want to like everything that he likes, because I want to be friends with him.
There was a report last year that Nolan wasn't really a fan of the old purple. So I think the adjustment, you know, hopefully finds its way into his good graces. John Gray, enthusiastic, fun John Gray, said, quote, "I love it! Exclamation point. It's really purple. It's unique. Make it purple, not navy. Let's go." Hell yeah, John Gray.
Maybe they can make it purple, he can use not like navy. That kind of purple, maybe it'll draw out ghosts more. The lilac draws the ghosts when he's searching for ghosts. By the way, John Gray searches for ghosts.
Yeah, he does.
He's a ghost hunter.
Which is awesome. He's a ghost guy. But I like it.
No, it makes me throw out everything that I own that has Rockies purple on it, and I've invested all in brand new lilac Rockies merchandise.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it hurt my future child's college fund, but you know, I think it's sometimes you just gotta make sacrifices.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, I don't care. I think it's a good thing. I'm looking back at how long we've been talking about the purple on this, and not just the fact that we, you know, are a thing named after being purple, but one of our earliest tweets about this is from May 14th. 2014, and it says, quote, "I think we've discussed this before, but anyone else annoyed by the fact that the Rockies wear purple helmets but not purple hats? That's one thing." We discussed the fact very early on. There was a tweet in 2014 in which we discussed how the purple doesn't match on the bill of the cap and on the jersey. The discussion has gone on for quite some time, and, you know, the Rockies have listened to us. Obviously, we made this happen.
Yeah, because we are the best.
Duh. Just don't ever wear the black vest with purple sleeves again, because that's the way those were designed. They were worn for one game in, I think, 2005 in San Francisco, and it was the ugliest goddamn thing I've ever seen in my life.
It wasn't great.
Horrible. So that is that. Colorado Rockies, new look. In many different ways for 2017. What else do we have to discuss? Anything?
I think I actually have to go to work.
All right, go to work. Jason Schwartz of the Lancaster Jethawks will join the show. We'll talk California League. We'll talk guys he's excited to see in 2017 and the affiliation change for the Rockies' new high A partner in the minor league system. Jason Schwartz coming up. Well, it's our like 95th attempt at getting this interview recorded for episode number 94 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, but we're very excited for this week's guest for the latest edition of the show. Jason Schwartz, the radio voice of the Lancaster Jethawks, the new Class A advanced affiliate of the Rockies, joins us for the first time. What's going on, man? How are you?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's good to talk to you. Well, we started yesterday, and we were set to make such good jokes because Anthony is the radio voice of the Long Beach State men's basketball team. You're the radio voice of the Long Beach State women's basketball team, so we were all set to have like a full-on Long Beach State basketball segment of the show. But then Anthony had to leave today because he's driving down to do a game. You're on your way to do a game, but it's this is the place to be for all things Long Beach State hoops, I guess.
I actually was thinking about that. We got off to such a good start yesterday on the podcast.
I know.
I was wondering, would we try to recreate that?
I don't think so. I don't think you can recapture that match.
I guess it would feel a little bit forced, but but we did mention yesterday that this is a place, the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, for all your Long Beach State men's and women's basketball information.
We're catering to our base, obviously. Very much the group that we want to appease is the Long Beach State basketball community, so we're all set. We'll save all of that for a future conversation, which Anthony can join us. But for now, we'll talk a little bit of baseball. We'll talk some Lancaster Jethawks. Jason, the radio voice of the Jethawks, formerly an affiliate of the Houston Astros, now in 2017, an affiliate of the Colorado Rockies, signed a player development contract with the Rockies this offseason after the Modesto Nuts, the former Rockies affiliate in the California League, was purchased by the Seattle Mariners. Mariners stay in the Cal League. They were kind of up for grabs at one time. But, Jason, take us through this affiliation change September, October, November, when you guys kind of had an inkling that this was coming and the process with the Rockies and how it's been for the Jethawks so far.
Yeah, well, unofficially, I kind of had an inkling throughout the season that it might be our last year with the Astros. They had expressed some interest. There were rumors that they wanted to move to the Carolina League for multiple reasons, and maybe, you know, foremost being that they wanted to be closer to their spring training facility down in Florida. We had a long 8-year run with them, but it kind of seemed like that was coming to an end. And so I was sort of keeping my eye out all season to see which other organizations might end up in Lancaster. And you mentioned Seattle. That was probably the one I thought was most likely because they were in Bakersfield. Whether Bakersfield left the Cal League or not, figured that the Mariners might want to move to a spot elsewhere, and they actually were our first affiliate back when the Jethawks got started in 1996. So I thought that was a pretty good fit. And then the Modesto thing happened, which came late in the season and I think caught a lot of people off guard. But that then left the Rockies open, and I think the Rockies then shot to the top of the list as one of the more likely organizations to be affiliated with us. So that kind of happened, you know, right at the end of the season, and then the dominoes fell with the Carolina Mudcats going with the Milwaukee Brewers, and that left us with the Rockies, and I think it's a great fit. And for me personally, it's a return to the Rockies, which I'm excited about because I was the radio broadcaster with the Tri-City Dust Devils in 2011, a Rockies affiliate at the time, and even better for me is that my manager in 2011 was Freddie Ocasio. The hitting coach was Anthony Sanders, and Freddie will be the manager this season in Lancaster, and Anthony Sanders will be on our field staff as well, so that'll be exciting to get back with them. I enjoyed working with them, and that year in 2011, we went to the championship series. We lost, but it was a really good team. Christian Bergman was the leader of that team. Probably the most notable name. He was the Northwest League Pitcher of the Year last year. So had great time with the Rockies in 2011. I'm excited to get it going again in Lancaster.
What was Christian Bergman's hair situation back in 2011?
He had the flow going for sure. He did have the flow going.
He
was great. I mean, he pitched two games. Now, granted, the Northwest League, and especially in the Tri-Cities, it's very pitcher-friendly. But I very much enjoyed working when he would pitch because I think he had two games that ended up being under 2 hours. He had an hour and 58 and an hour and 59. I mean,
that is the dream.
He tore through that league. He was so efficient. I loved watching him pitch, and I'm really glad to see him have an extended stay in the big leagues with the Rockies.
And you get a chance, like you said, to work with a couple of guys on staff who you've worked with before, Freddie Ocasio and Anthony Sanders. And the Rockies are no strangers to the California League. They've been in Modesto for quite some time. We discussed a lot on the podcast that it seemed like geographically it would have made a lot of sense for the Rockies to get into Carolina, but the Brewers end up getting that affiliation. So the Rockies, you don't want to say, are the odd man out, but Lancaster and Colorado is the last Class A advanced affiliation to come together, and it's because of a changing dynamic in the California League. And I want you to talk a little bit about that, because at the end of last season, Bakersfield and High Desert, two teams that had long had their futures thrown in question due to ballpark situations and economic situations and all things of that like, those two clubs move into the Carolina League in Buies Creek and Down East, which is the name for a team that is in Kinston, North Carolina. So the Carolina League goes from 8 teams to 10 teams. The California League contracts from 10 teams to 8 teams. And the dynamic of the league is very different, because Lancaster has an offensive-friendly reputation, and deservedly so. But High Desert was really the other place that was a launching pad in the Cal League. So the Cal League seems like it's going to kind of even out. What does the dynamic feel like right now with an 8-team league there?
Well, again, I do want to thank you again. I mentioned this yesterday for teaching me the pronunciation of Buies Creek, because I was going to have to find that somewhere before getting on the air this season. So Buies Creek, good to know.
Now you know.
It'll be interesting, and I think that, you know, you mentioned our offensive-friendly ballpark. I think that is really the main reason why we were one of the last teams standing there, just because, you know, teams – look at our place and they think, well, maybe it's hard to judge talent, whether or not, you know, pitchers' ERAs are inflated or hitters' numbers are inflated. But you know, look, I mean, you got the team with the most offensive-friendly ballpark in the big leagues joining up with a team with maybe the most offensive-friendly ballpark in the minor leagues, certainly at this level. And I saw someone joke that they were going to rename the hangar Coors Light, which I liked very much. The dynamic will be interesting. I've always been someone who has fought for the reputation of the league, in that, you know, so many people out there are so quick to throw away numbers from the Cal League and performances from the Cal League because of the offensive-friendly parks in High Desert and Lancaster. But as many of your listeners probably know, in Modesto, I mean, that is a very pitcher-friendly ballpark. And the numbers showed that the last few years with the Nuts and their great pitching staff. And then you look at some of the other teams. Inland Empire is a tough place to hit the ball out of. Lake Elsinore is a good park for pitchers. Rancho, fairly even, maybe slightly benefiting hitters on certain days. So I think without High Desert, the dynamic will change a lot. And I think when you look at numbers throughout the league, you can really trust what you are seeing more than in the past, even though, as I said, I've always been a big proponent of, you know, taking the numbers at face value in the Cal League outside of Lancaster and High Desert.
If you want an idea of sort of what it can be like on nights in Lancaster, Jason and I hooked up for a story back in November. Lancaster game in 2016 was named the Minor League Baseball Game of the Year. It won the Milby Award for a 29-11 Lancaster win over Stockton, which was back on May 26th. And there are certain nights, and it's something that, you know, the Rockies are obviously well aware of and that Rockies fans should be aware of. There are certain nights in Lancaster where you're going to see that happen, where the wind blows out. It's a night where the ball travels well and games will get a little bit wonky. So for people who have not experienced anything about the Lancaster Jethawks or just how that can be, it's not necessarily a regular event, but kind of tell us about that and why it is in Lancaster.
Oh man, I mean, they're the weirdest nights. They're the weirdest games to watch. You just kind of scratch your head. You watch the balls fly out. I mean, basically, what we've got in Lancaster, it's a mix. It's the High Desert, so it's very dry, and the wind blows very hard out to right field. And you just get these nights. I mean, they say hitting is contagious, and, you know, you watch it happen in front of you. I mean, just to get 7 home runs that night, you know, for a team that actually we hadn't hit that many home runs think we hit almost as many home runs that night as we did the entire month of April. It's just weird to watch, and you just sit back and you enjoy it, and you just marvel at it and realize that, you know, you're really not going to see anything like this anywhere else. But you know, it's still the outlier. I mean, you know, you can get great performances in Lancaster from a pitcher. And I always go back to a game we had in High Desert back in 2013 when we lost, I think it was 30-8 one day. We were down 20-2 in the second inning. And then the very next day, our starter Kyle Smith goes out there and throws a complete game shutout.
Makes perfect sense. Park.
So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's baseball, and anything can happen on any night. And I think that is certainly the case in Lancaster more than other spots.
Jason, tell us a little bit about the Jethawks as an organization. Like you said, joined the California League in 1996, a handful of different affiliations. The last several years, there's been a run of really good talent through Lancaster through the partnership, the affiliation with the Houston Astros. I mean, when the Astros were starting to bring up really big names, I mean, obviously Carlos Correa, I know Tyler White was there. Some of these big names in the Astros organization have gone through Lancaster in recent seasons. But as an organization, I mean, if people are going to go out to a game in Lancaster, what are the draws to taking into a Jethawks game?
Well, we've got a nice setup in Lancaster. I mean, it's a nice ballpark. It was built in the mid 90s. So, you know, it's certainly not one of your brand new ballparks that are popping up. But the 90s, that was when the Cal League had their surge of new ballparks. And ours has held up well. We have a really, really strong fan base. I mean, I'm not just saying that, but I really do think when I go around the Cal League, I mean, I see tons of Jethawks fans who travel throughout the league. In the playoffs in the past, we've had really, really good turnouts in the playoffs where, you know, you don't always see that. So we do have a passionate fan base there, and they have enjoyed some winning baseball over the last five seasons. And, in fact, when I got there in 2012, they were coming off of the three worst seasons in the franchise's history, and I was kind of expecting more of the same. The Astros were a little bit thin in the minor leagues, and then that's when all the changes started happening. That was when Jeff Luno took over, and all of a sudden we're seeing George Springer, we're seeing Carlos Correa, most recently Alex Bregman, A.J. Reed, and just a ton of guys. Team won its first championship in 2012, was a favorite to win in 2013, lost in the playoffs, and won it again in 2014. In the last 5 years, they've been in the playoffs every year. So that's what the fans in Lancaster have enjoyed over the last few seasons. And I mean, I don't know too much about what we're going to get yet with the Rockies. But from everything I've seen, I think that they can expect to enjoy some winning baseball in 2017 as well.
Well, and you're going to get a bunch of pieces, obviously, from the Asheville Tourists, who are now the next step down the ladder from Lancaster, and prospects from Lancaster who graduate to Double-A will go to Hartford. So that's where it fits in the chain for anybody who is confused as to where exactly Class A Advanced is on the ladder. But that Asheville team last year has some really interesting pieces. You're probably going to get a chance to see Brendan Rodgers for a considerable portion of this year. That is one of the guys that this fan base is really anxious to see. Have you gotten a chance? I mean, at this stage, obviously over the off season for you, it's not really an off season because you're doing college stuff and people don't probably realize that broadcasters have a lot of other gigs when it's not just baseball season. But have you gotten a chance to look at any of these bigger pieces that are going to be coming in next year?
Well, I definitely looked at Brendan Rodgers for sure. And I think that people around the Jethawks are anticipating that we'll see him for some time. And, I mean, that'll be tremendous considering, you know, the shortstops we've gotten to see, not only in Lancaster, but in the league. I mean, the Cal League, we saw, you know, Carlos Correa, we saw Corey Heager, Alex Bregman. We have really been fortunate to see some incredible shortstop prospects come through. And I know the talk around not just Lancaster, but the league, that Brian Rodgers will be and someone that people in Lancaster and throughout the Cali will really enjoy watching.
For you at this stage, Jason, for people who are unaware of the, you know, what all it takes to be a minor league broadcaster. I mean, right now, February 23rd, so you still got about 6 weeks or so until opening day. But what is the process now for you getting prepped for not just a new roster, which is an every season thing, but a new organization, which is, you know, a once every 4 years at the most type of thing. From now until opening day, what is the stuff that you're going to be working on?
Well, first of all, the focus right now is finishing up basketball season, and we've got a team that could potentially go into the postseason and most likely will. So get done with that about mid-March. Probably at the beginning of March is when I'll really start diving in once I get the Baseball America prospect handbook and baseball prospectus, and go back and look at that Asheville team, look at the Modesto team from last year, check out guys who might, who might likely be with us to begin the season. I'm hoping to get out to spring training. That's one thing that's great about this affiliation now, is that the Rockies are in Arizona, which is much easier for us to access than when the Astros were in Florida. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it, in mid to late March. But I also find that cramming right before the season begins doesn't always lead to success. It just leads to exhaustion because, you know, there's only so much you can get right in. So, you know, so many things come, through the first couple weeks of the season. And like I said, with being with Freddie Acacio and Anthony Sanders, I think it'll be a smooth transition. I'm sure they'll help me out a lot to tell me what I'm looking at and who I should watch out for. So I think it's going to be as smooth as can be. And, just trying to keep it stress-free, trying to make sure I get all my hours of sleep before the season starts, because you need them. You need that reserve once you get going.
Yeah, those definitely come at a premium, especially in the Cal League where there are not a whole lot of short road trips. And for you guys, kind of not so much out on an island now, but geographically, the two closest teams to Lancaster are the two that depart, so there aren't really any super quick swings. You're not, Visalia. Visalia's out in the middle of nowhere now in the Cal League, but kind of an interesting dynamic for 2017 in the California League. Jason Schwartz is on Twitter. You can follow him at Jason D. Schwartz, and we're going to be checking in with him throughout this season to get a read on that Lancaster team, how things are looking in the California League, and hopefully hear some fun Brendan Rodgers stories. Also, Peter Lambert, who was a draft pick of a couple of seasons ago, made 26 starts last year in Asheville, was very good, so you're probably going to get him, and you can confirm to us if he is, in fact, three toddlers wearing a trench coat, because he looks like he's 7 years old.
All right, well, I look forward to that for sure.
That's your assignment. All right, man, thanks for doing this. Well, it's going to be fun getting a chance to talk to you in a non-me requesting an interview through you context. So we'll do this a lot this season.
Hey, man, anytime. I'm really looking forward to it. Excited to be part of the Rocks fam now.
We'll get out of here. Episode number 94 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast wrapping up. We're going to roll out some new shirts for 2017 with the good folks at Humble Monster.
There are
going to
be some good ones too, guys.
We'll get in touch with them on that, and I think that's about all.
I mean,
big thanks to Jason Schwartz. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason D. Schwartz.
I'm super excited about some of the shirts we got cooking up this year. They're gonna be good.
Yeah, this is gonna be fun. We'll have some fun with it. All right, go to work.
All right, if I have to.
See you next month.
Bye.
See you next month, and we'll talk to you soon, all of you listening. Bye. Bye.
Hey.
Eh?
That actually worked.
There we go.
I said to turn my thing off and turn it back on again.
Yeah, sometimes it gets all fucking dicked.
Blow in the cartridge and
I was playing Nintendo the other day and realized that that's still my only mode for trying to make it work.
What other mode is there?
I don't think there is one.
I don't know.
There is one. And then when you get really frustrated, sometimes you just smack the side of the actual console.
Yep.
Come on. Work.